Chrissy Hewitt, and on behalf of co-host Stephen DeLuque, welcome you to part two of the Ears on Art 19-year anniversary. As with last week, we're giving you a few excerpts of some programs past.
12 women, one straw bale barn built by the three little pigs, three traditional Scottish ballads, two sisters, and one Scotsman, all for the purpose of walking the blanket. Hello, this is Stephen DeLuque, and you are listening to Ears on Art. Chrissy Hewitt now takes us to Atascadero, to the Straw Bale Barn Weaving Studio, conceived and owned by sisters Kathleen and Rosemary Thorne. The activity of the day is walking the blanket.
I was to arrive right after lunch, an hour Norman had determined to be a time of good energy for the work of walking the blanket. I enter to the sound of happy voices. These workshop participants had been together much of the previous 3 weeks, learning precious skills about weaving, spinning, and dyeing from one of the greats in this field, Norman Kennedy. Scottish-born and for many years a resident of Vermont, in September of 2003, he was a recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts Heritage Fellowship. The barn is large. 2 6-foot folding work tables are set end to end. The blanket, about to be walked, is one designed and woven by artist Roberta Foster. The wool cloth measures 10 yards in length and approximately a yard wide. Eventually, it will be cut in thirds and sewn into a queen-size blanket. For now, the ends have been sewn together, forming a continuous loop. The width has been bundled into about an 8-inch diameter of cloth. It has been washed and is still wet, though much of the excess water has been squeezed out. As the blanket is brought to the table, the ice-cold vodka bottle is cracked open, and shots are distributed in unceremonious plastic or paper cups. The women take seats around the table, with Norman sitting at one end. The material is passed down until all have part of the oval in front of them. Imagine yourself at the table, reaching out with both hands. Gather the wool that is in front of you. Pick it up. Rotate your hands to the thumb side up position and pound the cloth downward. Pass what is in your hands to your left. Thump it down and release. Pick up what has just been passed to you and repeat. Why is this done? It is a felting process. Now through song, this internationally known folk singer keeps the rhythm. Let your ears take in the sounds. Let your nose take in the comfortable odor of clean, wet wool.
This is a form of belting the cloth. Some of these songs, the Gaelic songs, were made specifically for this. Some of them from the 1600s, 1700s, quite common. This is only for blanketing. This doesn't need a lot of felting. The old blanketings would need a lot of felting because the rooms, the houses were so drafty. They didn't have slickers, you know, so they had to get their woolen cloth really tight and so that they could get windproof and somewhat waterproof. God help them. That's all they had. So, and you're doing it J-shell, you know, sun-wise. It would be really unlucky to do it against the sun. It would be putting a curse on it.
The process stops while Norman checks the condition and width of the cloth. All is proceeding nicely, so they start a second song.
Cooper, he come here last night with trembling, he was weary. A trooper, he come here last night when the moon was shining clearly. Bonnie lassie, I'll lie wi' ye, yeah. Bonnie lassie, I'll lie wi' ye. Oh God, I.
Hello, this is Stephen DeLuque. Today, co-host Krissa Hewitt and I interweave two separate interviews. We recorded a conversation with photographer Joe Schwartz at his home and studio in Atascadero. We also had the opportunity to speak with his agent, Michael Shapiro, of the Shapiro Gallery in San Francisco. We began today's show with Michael declaring that he can tell a great deal about the personality of a photographer by the imagery they choose to record. Joe has told us that the best introduction to his photographs is to read his book, Folk Photography, Poems I've Never Written. So now I read a brief quote from that volume in Joe's own words. I sought old images, remembering overwhelming, suffocating smells of the laborer's beer and whiskey breaths, the garlic sweat filtering through dirt-stained clothes, smoke from black cigars and hand-rolled cigarettes, filling all leftover space in an atmosphere where massive bodies of grim men communicated in shouts and scowled laughing. Joe continues, the search continued before and after World War II. My photos for me are symbolic glimpses of the past and art-like images of newfound folktale experiences. Like free souls, grown-ups and children dance with their conversations. Textures of the skin and clothing, creases and folds. People's peculiar stances are storylines well articulated. The streets are full of telling hieroglyphics, folk scenes to be studied, giving us a clearer understanding of the past and present. Folk strength struggling for survival against tough and miserable environmental odds. People perform in dance patterns on the pages of my documented street histories. And now, Michael Shapiro and Joe Schwartz.
Good afternoon, Michael.
Hello.
Can you just give us a brief synopsis of the gallery that you have in San Francisco? It's a photography gallery?
Yes, I've been a photography dealer for 26 years now. I focus on black and white, 20th century. I focus on very classic photography, and I'm very interested in the social documentary photographers, including and especially the one we're about to discuss today, Joe Schwartz.
And how did you discover or...
Somebody had Joe's book, and Joe was very surprised. I saw it, and I tracked him down. I called him one day, and in this business, you don't get used to people being so available and so friendly as Joe was. Joe really felt like he wanted people to see his photographs, and I understood why when I saw the book and when I eventually saw the actual photographs, because, you know, Joe is really a freedom fighter. He was convinced, if you look at his photography, that the races can live together in peace and harmony, as he did in Bedford-Stuyvesant in the 30s and 40s. Communities were mixed. And I think that the main factor was poverty. I called Joe shortly before his 90th birthday, and he said, I can't talk to you now. I'm making anti-Bush posters because I'm going to march. And I thought, this guy... How many decades is that he has been moving on his convictions?
Good afternoon, Joe.
Good afternoon.
And Stephen is
yeah,
here,
it
of
is.
Course.
Hello, Joe.
Has this been a lifelong pursuit of photography? When did it start for you?
Well, I would say, seriously speaking, it started when I belonged to the Citizen Civics Affairs Committee.
Which is about what year?
I think that was around, I'd say around 38, 39.
Okay. And so what was it about being part of that movement that
well,
got you started with the photography?
As you can see in this little march here, which didn't happen very often, any kind of marches where you found black people marching at any time, and you could see the sign behind her there.
Which
Citizen
is,
Civics Affairs Committee.
And what city are we in?
Well, we're in Brooklyn here.
Okay.
Later on, we had other demonstrations where NAACP, they came out and really begin to demonstrate. I think this was a union just forming. What they were interested in was in inclusion, meaning that they wanted to be included in unions and so on.
Michael, when did you first become really interested about carrying his work and representing him?
Well, immediately. I mean, I ran after him. I was just I was intrigued by his imagery, but not only the civil rights imagery, but I mean, I love the way he's captured children, and I especially love like what he's most known for are his urban pictures.
Mm-hmm. It became interest to me actually through a friend who's a black guy. His name is Johnny Atkinson. He brought me into the homes, and I thought they were, you know, they were a lot of broken down homes, seen photographs, and they were interesting. And I thought they make interesting subject matter as far as art is concerned.
Had you had some training about how to use a camera at this point, or was this all
not
just,
very much? No.
Just things that you taught yourself along the way.
Crummy little camera.
I've always said I can look at a photographer's work and tell you what the photographer is going to be like personally. Mm-hmm. And this is a real tribute to what Joe's about. How many white people were photographing the black community in the 30s and 40s?
Later on, I was working in a union shop. I used to hear some really terrible things, and I was already beginning to argue the idea of whether black people were people or not, you know. It was really that kind of discussion. And I had to prove these things. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, maybe there's one way of proving is by, you know, taking photographs.
Chroniclers of daily life of people struggling humanity to his work.
Today we get to visit with one of the doyens of the art scene here in San Luis Obispo, Josephine Crawford. She has had a huge influence on the art world in this area. Good afternoon, Josephine.
Hi, Stephen. How are you?
And Krissa.
Hi.
Josephine and I have been friends for many years, going back to, I think it was SLAG.
Yes, it was. I loved it.
Which was the San Luis Obispo Artists Gallery, which was a co-op gallery, which was in the Creamery many years ago.
I went in one time because Rosie Rosenthal and some other artists had been doing another gallery further up.
Something like Art Lives Here.
Art Lives Here. So they said, okay, this is going well. Let's do Art Lives Here too. So they'd got the space down in the Creamery, and I went over there, and it was so exciting. It was a real co-op, real high-energy place. Very nice.
Yeah, yeah. We kept it up almost 4 years. Yeah.
Gail Johnson had started Art After Dark. What a splendid idea it was. And she thought it would be a good idea to do an art walk, and she came up with the title Art After Dark. Art After Dark, and then I saw this trolley. And I put two and two together, and I thought that would be ever so cute to have people getting on the trolley and going around town. And instead of an art walk, it would be an art ride sort of thing. So we went to the city, and they gave us the trolley for a year, and we made flags. I think that really got Art After Dark going. It got much more, I think, interesting, because I think SLAG and all the artists down there brought a lot of attention to the growing art community here.
You really got something started, you and Gail, and that is so incredible.
Well, it was a wonderful thing to do some marketing on the back of, as it were, sort of. So the driver and I kind of collaborated on where we would go, and we sort of skidded around from place to place for a whole year before everybody started noticing that wasn't on the official route or some such.
It was interesting. They pulled it because of some violation of privilege or something like that.
It was a federal and state thing. You couldn't use city transportation for private events. I don't know. It seemed like a very win-win thing for both the city and for the artists in town. Anyway, it lasted a couple of years, the trolley business, but Art After Dark has grown since. And as you say, Art Obispo took it over, thank God, because, boy, it was hard work.
How long have you been in San Luis Obispo?
About 30 years. I followed Jim, my husband, here. We were in Arizona, and he came over to go to Cal Poly.
And you were in Arizona. Was that Arco Santi?
Yes. Yes, it was Arco Santi. I don't know if your listeners know about it, but it's an experiment in urban complex living. In other words, buildings that one large building and the natural environment growing all around it and using solar energy. It was a wonderful experiment. I was there for about 4 years. I started doing watercolour there, and I was really making a transition, I believe, from the stage to art. And I was doing a lot of watercolour out there. Arcosanti was a moment of changing my sensibility.
You had mentioned dancing just now, and that's because before this you were a costume designer in Las Vegas.
Right. That was part of it, yeah. So I was doing dance for about 14, 15 years, and everywhere really, and doing stage and TV and whatnot. And then my last dancing job was in Las Vegas at the Sahara. A friend of mine had a boyfriend who was a producer, and he was doing shows, and he needed costume designer. So I could draw, and I can paint, and I knew what dancers had to wear, and so I started doing costume design and loved it for about 10 years. Worked in many casinos in Vegas and Atlantic City. It was beautiful, but it didn't satisfy my desire to get a little deeper, shall we say. The costumes were pretty and everything was pretty, but I was maturing and I wanted to express myself and my deeper feelings.
You said that you knew how to draw and how to paint. So yes. When did all of that start in your life?
It started, I believe genetically, I have an ability to draw realistically. I've always been able to, as long as I can remember. But I had a father who was an artist, and although he died early, I think I have his genes. And I've always sort of been able to draw realistically, three-dimensionally. I used to just do it all the time as a child. Then I went to art school to do dance, but it was not just dance. There was dance and art and music. I was thinking about that today, actually. In my ballet, my report card was always ballet, was always B+, but my art classes were always A, and it used to irritate me because I didn't care about the damn art. I wanted to be this great dancer, right? But apparently I could always do it. It's just that I didn't set my goal that way. I wanted to be on the stage, you know, so... But it was there for when I couldn't dance anymore.
And where was this?
It was in Hertfordshire in England, a place called Tring. It was a beautiful physical school. It was an old manor house, went back to Henry VIII or further back even. So it was a marvelous environment. And to be in a school from the age of, I guess, 10, where... everything was integrated, our art and our history lessons and our math, and everything was all to do with art, really. What a gift that was. Because I don't think other people quite understand what art does to the mind. I feel that children just really need it so badly to be successful. I hate the idea that it isn't integrated into our school system here.
Certainly, we've seen an awful lot of declining availability of the arts in schools. But even when they were there, and to the extent that they still are, it isn't about integration in most cases.
You can actually teach art in schools, but it has to reference other things. You can do art if it supports math, for instance, or you can do art if it supports reading or something, but you can't do it the other way around, which is what my school did. In my history class, we did history of art part of the history was because it's part of history, you know. And if you don't understand that, or if you don't use that tool to understand history, you're missing out because it's as we all know, because at being artists, a lot of times it's the forerunner of change and creativity. I was thinking about creativity the other day and how technology is worrying me, because not because I don't love it, because I love it, but it seems like you're never allowed to be bored anymore. Because if you're bored, bing bing. I think that creativity a lot of times comes from boredom, to where you sitting around, you don't know what to do on a windy afternoon. You're going to draw something or think things in your imagination, and if you're never bored, you never have to do that.
Next month, Ears on Art starts year 20. Thanks so much for listening.